The material in this podcast is for information purposes only. It does not represent the opinions of Vested Finance and is not intended to be investment advice. We recommend you to consult with a financial advisor before committing to any financial decisions. Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 18 of our Vested Finance podcast. I'm Kaihan, your co-host. Joining us for today's session is Jarwin, one of the co-founders of Vested Finance.
Great to be here again, Kai.
Our discussion today will revolve around Apple's and Tesla's earnings, inevitably. But first, for those who have kept in touch with the stock market, the name GameStop has been a frequent mention this past week. So Jarwin, can you tell us what happened?
Okay, the GameStop saga. Much has been written in mainstream media, Twitter, about the GameStop saga. The narrative is now the battle between retail traders started with the folks at Wall Street Bets, which is a subreddit, and a bunch of hedge funds who have placed short positions in stocks such as GameStop, AMC, theaters, and others. So the saga actually started about a year ago. Here's a little bit of a high-level summary. A little over a year ago, a Wall Street Bet Reddit user with the username DeepFuckingValue posted his long position, which is a bet that the stock is going to go up as early as the second half of 2019. At that time, when he posted it, people actually did not believe his investment thesis. He believed that GameStop was actually a lot more optimistic than what the mainstream media, you know, the death of retails and so on and so forth. And then sometime around then, Michael Burry, the famed investor from the movie Big Short, who was played by Christian Bale, joined the long position as he also saw that the stock is overshorted and this can lead to a short squeeze in the long term. Just a little bit of a tangent. What's a short position? A short position is a bet that the share price of a particular stock will decline in the future. By taking a short position, investors borrow stocks to sell now with the expectation that the stock price will go down. So then if the stock price goes down, the investors can buy it at a lower price, return the shares that they borrowed, and pocket the difference. But if the short price goes up instead, they have to buy the stocks at a higher price to cover the initial loan. But the act of buying these shares to cover the initial loan could actually create a cycle where the share price further goes up. This is called a short squeeze. This is actually quite a risky bet because share prices can rise without an upper limit. So the losses for the short sellers can be unbounded. Meanwhile, the opposite direction, right? Share price can only go to zero. In a normal working market, the ability to short a company can provide the incentive for investors to find unscrupulous companies that are faking their books. For example, Jim Chanos shorted Enron before it was discovered that they were faking their books, one of the biggest accounting fraud. A more recent example is Muddy Waters Research, whose investigation into Luckin Coffee uncovered that they were faking their numbers as well. But the thing with short sellers hedge fund is that, yes, some are uncovering illegal activities, but some are also betting that certain companies will not do well in the future, and then they can wage a media campaign to tilt the share price of the company their direction. This is sort of what happened in the case of GameStop. What this user, DeepFuckingValue, this subreddit user discovered was that through his analysis, that the company is not in as precarious condition as the media and the hedge funds are making it to be. So in August 2020, when the share price of GameStop was under $5, he made another video on YouTube explaining the macro outlook for GameStop, which is actually not bad. There's a new console launch. They are largely free cash flow positive for a lot of their stores, which does not justify the extremely short positions in the stock, especially at share prices that low, right? So he realized that this does not match the reality, the fundamentals of the company. Then that kind of started the snowball. Over time, retail traders started placing bets that the stock will increase in the future, either through buying the stocks outright or buying options on margins, amplifying the trade volume, mainly through Robinhood, because Robinhood makes this so easy. Now, this is building up into a short squeeze. And this past week, mainstream media started covering the phenomenon and then further ingraining it into mainstream recognition. More and more retail traders joined the foray, pushing the stock even higher. Now, as the stock price edged higher, hedge funds got squeezed. Again, they have to buy back stocks at a higher price to cover their initial shorts. At this point, we do not know if these hedge funds have closed their initial positions. It seems unlikely, but GameStop stock is still heavily shorted. At its peak, it was shorted about 140% of total stocks available. Some of these stocks are owned by management and therefore are not liquid. This means more people borrow to bet the share price to go down than there are shares available. Now, with the wider retail participation on a handful of extremely volatile stocks, disruption in the market occurred on Thursday, January 28, 2020. The additional volume and volatility caused stresses in the market. NASDAQ stopped trading on GameStop's 19 times on this day as the share price repeatedly hit the volatility circuit breaker. Now, the impact was not limited to GameStop or the shorted stocks either. Widespread outages, trading disruptions were reported on many investing platforms.
All of this volatility caused some of the largest retail brokers to stop taking new buy orders. Why was this the case?
Yes, on January 28th, some of the largest retail brokers in the world stopped taking new buy orders for some of these high-flying stocks, GameStop, AMC, and others. Generally, there are several reasons why they did this, but the primary reason is really mitigating the risk for the broker and liquidity concerns. Even though trades appear instantaneous on your apps when you're investing, in reality, there's a lag. There's a lot of machinations in the market, counterparties, market makers, brokers, exchange. They have to communicate with another and then the clearinghouse. So generally, it takes 2 days for trades to settle. Because of there's a lag between when investors book new positions in the stock and when their cash is actually exchanged for securities, brokerage like Robinhood and others have to maintain deposit accounts at the clearing firms to help finalize trades. Clearing firms such as Depository Trust and Clearing Corp, DTCC. They require brokerage to put some money in this bank account as collateral. Now, what happened with the market, all these retail traders investing in these high volatility stocks, risk was amplified because if one side of the trade does not come up with the cash after 2 days, the brokerage has to foot the bill. This amplifies the risk for the brokers when the market becomes extremely volatile. Number two, it's actually a liquidity concern. Because of this, the DTCC may maintain a collateral requirement for all these brokers. And on January 28th, the DTCC bumped their collateral requirement from $26 billion to $33.5 billion, a 29% increase in 1 day. So for some of these stocks, the DTCC actually increased the collateral requirement from a typical range 2.5-15% to 100%. So this means if an investor invests $1 in GameStop stock through Robinhood, for example, Robinhood has to add $1 to its collateral account with the DTCC. That's why on Thursday, it didn't have enough collateral. He had to stop trading some of these stocks, stop adding buy positions, and raise more funds, drawing its credit line and drawing funds from private investors. Although Friday, it has opened it again, but it's still opening at a limited volume. Other brokers have different reasons, but Interactive Brokers, the CEO, went on CNBC and said, yeah, it's to protect the brokerage firm. In case some of these trades go belly up, the brokers have to be responsible for the losses.
Yeah, I suppose that makes sense. Then what's the impact on the market?
Yeah, so this phenomenon caused distortions in the broad market. I think the first is the volume problem. The US market, with all this sudden increase in retail participation globally in these handful of stocks, the plumbing in the market is getting strained. Before, you have largely institutional investors moving large blocks of shares, right? Now you have a lot of retail investors moving small number of shares at high frequency. The different parties within the stock market, you know, the exchanges, the brokers, the vendors that maintains books and records, the counterparties and the clearinghouse, they communicate with one another with this electronic messaging system, and that's getting bogged down. So what you're seeing as a result is when you're placing trades, that's getting delayed. It's not executing as fast as it normally would. It's that you're not getting confirmation. This is a market-wide issue. Number two, it's actually also distorting the performance of all the other assets. Some of these hedge funds that are facing the squeeze are selling long-term positions to cover money-losing short position. This is causing an elevated level of sell-off. So you see a lot of the blue chips and the indexes are actually going down. And I think the third is, in an attempt to catch lightning in a bottle twice, some investors are betting that this phenomenon will expand into other heavily shorted stocks, whether it's true or not. But remember, finding a heavily shorted stock is easy. The hard part is creating a mass coordination, as what has happened with GameStop and a handful of other stocks. And finally, remember that some people are now trying to pump heavily shorted, underperforming stocks as if they're the next GameStop. But remember that GameStop might be unique. The saga has been more than a year in the making. It started off with a fundamental analysis that happened sometime in 2019. Some people might be pumping other underperforming stocks as the next GameStop, trying to lure investors into a pump and dump scheme.
You know, this saga has definitely gripped investors. But that being said, all things must come to an end. Any ideas how?
Oh, it's like a game of musical chair. Someone is going to be left standing. It's not going to be pretty. Because at this point, even as everyone trying to enter the trade buying GameStop and some of these other heavily shorted stocks, it's starting to create disruptions in execution in the market. Imagine everyone rushing to the exit at the same time, possibly the same day. You saw a preview of this on January 28th. GameStop dropped, 20, 30, 40% in half a day when Robinhood decided to halt trading, halt adding new positions on GameStop. When this happens, it's going to happen very rapidly. So from a market execution perspective, when everyone's trying to sell at the same time, the market might break for a short amount of time. NASDAQ circuit breakers might be tripped again, halting trades. There might not be buying volume, so your orders may not get filled. At the end, someone will be left holding the bag because at this point, this is zero sum. Some money will be gained by some investors and will be lost by others.
Yeah, that won't end well. All right, moving on to Apple. Apple crossed the $100 billion mark for the first time. Can you share with us some key takeaways from this feat?
Yep. Apple's quarterly revenue crossed $100 billion mark for the first time. This is for the first quarter of its 2021 fiscal year, but it's really for the last 3 months of 2020. So it generated $111 billion quarterly revenue for the first time ever. Here are three high-level key takeaways. Net sales of all Apple's products increased by double-digit percentages. iPhone up 17%, Mac up 21%, iPad up 41%, wearables, home, and accessories up 30%, services up 24%. All in all, iPhone revenue topped $65 billion, which is a 17% increase over the same period last year. This is fueled again by the continuation of the work-from-home trend and people upgrading their phones. The second, sales also went up in all the regions. So the phenomenon was global. The largest increase were in Greater China, which saw a 57% increase, and Japan, 33% increase. Sales in the Americas, which is Apple's largest revenue region, also increased 12%. Now, the bump in net sales in Greater China is interesting because it's a lot more than expected. And it's probably because of two factors. The first is the decline in Huawei. Huawei, if you're not aware, is one of the premier smartphone makers from China. It experienced a ban by the US government under the Trump administration. So Huawei shipments dropped by 41% in 2020 due to the sanction that disrupted its supply chain. The US cut off Huawei's access to Android operating system and also cut off access to the latest chips for its devices. The second reason is 5G. 5G is becoming a must-have feature for smartphones in China. And as deployment of the new spectrum in China outpaces that of the US and even Europe, to put it in context, China has about 690,000 5G base stations compared to about 50,000 in the US. So this latest version of the iPhone sold in China is the first 5G iPhone. And the third takeaway, not only did net sales go up, gross margins went up as well. Apple's business unit can largely be separated into hardware and services. For services, you think about Apple Music, Fitness, News Plus, but really it's the App Store. The gross margin for services is at 68.4%, which is 4% higher than the same period last year. The services business is an important segment for Apple because it is much more profitable and may fuel future growth for Apple. Services allow Apple to extract more revenue from its install base, which has increased about 10% over the past year. Apple now claims that it has more than a billion iPhone install base. And gross margin for hardware also went up. It's at 35%, which is almost a percent higher than the previous year. This is notable because this is a reversal in trend we've seen from the past 2 years. This suggests that the hardware sales mix from this last period is more on the higher margin product, possibly the sales of iPhone Pro and Pro Max.
So that's that on Apple. Tesla too beat estimates.
You know, you live in strange times when Tesla's earnings do not dominate the investing news. So here are three takeaways from Tesla's Q4 earnings. The first, Tesla beat revenue estimates. It made $10.74 billion in revenue versus $10.4 expected, but it actually missed earnings by 20% on a per share basis. It made 80 cents EPS versus $1 EPS expected. The second, car deliveries and free cash flow were largely as expected. As car deliveries continue to increase, Tesla's cash position strengthens, which enables it to continue expansion of manufacturing capacity globally. And with global manufacturing expansion, Tesla expects the long-term average annual growth rate for vehicle delivery to be 50% year over year. This is notable because in 2019 to 2020, the car delivery growth rate increase was 22%. So they expected the long term to more than double that. And finally, the third, in the earnings call, Elon commented that Tesla is refocusing its efforts on the energy generation and storage business. This segment includes the deployment of solar panels and roofs and batteries, Powerwall and the Megapack for large installations. So just a little background. Typically, renewable energy production, such as wind and solar, are more volatile since they rely on the availability of wind and sun. In some wind farms, the wind is strongest at night, but the demand is also lowest, you know, because everyone's asleep, right? For these wind farms, they have to shut off the turbine because they cannot store the electricity they generated. So similarly, solar panels rely on the sun, which may fluctuate depending on the weather and cloud coverage, right? So because of the variability in supply of electricity through wind and solar, you need an energy storage solution such as a battery pack that can act as a buffer to provide more reliable supply. Tesla is trying to complete this loop, right, from the generation and also storage. Right now, the segment is still a very small portion of the company's business, but it's poised to grow. In 2020, despite the pandemic, the energy storage deployment grew 83% between 2019 and 2020. But as of 2020, it's only about 7% of revenue, and it's still not reliably profitable. Quarterly gross margin for the segment fluctuates anywhere between negative 5% to 6%. This last quarter was negative 5%. In contrast, the automotive revenue varies from 24 to 28%. For Tesla to meaningfully grow cash flow from this segment, it has to focus on lower installation costs and better integration between the storage and generation. So in summary, this is a pretty drama-free earnings for Tesla. But as in the case for the past several years for the company, the issue is how to justify the valuation. Or maybe it doesn't matter for Tesla. I don't know. Its market cap is about $750 billion or so, which is about seven times that of Ford and GM combined.
Well, that's all we have for GameStop, Apple, and Tesla. As for me, I'll definitely keep my eyes peeled on the outcome of the GameStop saga.
Until next week.
To our listeners, we hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. For more insights into markets and emerging technologies, please visit our blog at vested.co.in. As always, take care and stay safe.